I took something that normally, in my experience, even just to go through Tanya on a very basic level, would be like an hour class every week for 2 years, just to go on a very, very basic level. And this is sort of like the hurricane version of it. if you're daring, you know, if you have a, you have to drive. Let's say you're driving to San Bernardino and back or something. So it's like perfect for that type of thing. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Was that the topic? Rewire your brain. Okay, fine. Thank you for getting us back on topic. Okay. So let's start rewiring your brain. So let's start with how your brain is wired. A disclaimer here. I'm not a neurologist. This is just based on Chassidus and specifically on Chassidus Chabad, and probably more specifically on Tanya. So I was in Crown Heights, and I was driving my car, and I drove down the service lane of Eastern Parkway, where there is parallel parking on both sides of the service lane. And I was looking for a spot so I could go out onto Kingston Avenue and do some shopping. And as I drove by what appeared to be a spot, I saw that it was actually somebody's driveway. And he had a sign on his gate that said, "Don't even think of parking here." And I thought about that. I didn't think of parking there. I thought about the sign. The sign itself, it's setting you up for failure. Imagine if there were a billboard that said, "Don't picture a pink elephant." Boom, you lost. Everybody loses. I don't really have too much control over what I think of. Especially if there's some, you know, suggestion going on, then you know, it's almost like a reflex, almost like, you know, when the doctor taps your knee and you kick. Can't really help what I think of. So what could he have said? See, when you go to yeshiva, they teach you Talmudic logic. So we examine a text and we ask the question, what should it have said? So he says, "Don't even think of parking here." And that makes you think of parking there. What should he have said, or what could he have said? Not that he has a right to say it, but it would at least be tenable. It would be a realistic request. "Don't even think about parking here." Because I have control over that. I can control what I think about. I can't control what I think of, but I can control what I think about. I'll give you an example from this story itself. What's thinking of, what's thinking about? I see a spot, I look at it, and I say, "Whoa, parking spot." You know, faster than my words, faster than I can even formulate words. My brain tells me, "Whoa, parking spot." And then a fraction of a second later, I say, "Oh, no, driveway." But that half a second was thinking of parking there. So I already lost, okay? I'm already out of the game. I lose. I failed. That's thinking of. It happens automatically. I don't control it. What would be thinking about? Thinking about would be more like this. I roll up. I say, "Oh, parking spot. Oh, no, driveway. All right, no problem. It's a driveway. I will not, chas v'sholem, God forbid, I will not park in that driveway. That's a person's driveway. But I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit here for a minute and just picture myself parking in that spot. Are there any cars behind me? No, no cars behind me. Okay. I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to idle. And I can see it. I can visualize parallel parking right into that spot and how perfectly my car fits. Perfect spot, really. Great location. And I go out onto Kingston, and I go shopping, and then I come back, and I put my stuff in the car. And then this is all happening in my mind. Oh, wow, this spot is too good to give up. I'm going to go out and do some more shopping. And then it only took 30 seconds, but in my mind, you know, I was parked there for 3 hours in a fantasy. It was just a fantasy. And then after 30 seconds of thinking about parking there, never having parked there, not only I never parked there, I never intended of actually parking there. It was just an innocent, harmless fantasy of parking there. So now I was thinking about parking there for 30 seconds, and then I drive away and say, thanks a lot, buddy. I just thought about parking in your spot. Now, okay, that's kind of silly, but here's the reason I'm presenting it this way, because I want to ask a question. If he says, don't even think of parking there, and immediately I think of parking there, have I done anything wrong? I'll change the question. Have I done anything that I could not do or do differently next time? It's going to happen the same time, the same way every time. Don't even think of it. But if he were to have written, don't even think about parking here, and let's say I wanted to accommodate his request, and I made a decision, okay, I'm not going to think about parking there. Could I control that? Is that a behavior that I could select and adhere to? Do I get to choose what I fantasize about? Of course. Okay. So I'm using a rather silly example about a parking spot and about a sign and about things that don't have much of a moral implication. But let's just take that concept and import it into a moral framework. Will my creator ever tell me that a desire, an impulse, an urge should not even occur to me? Will he tell me that I have guilt just because I'm inclined to do something, or I feel a pull or an attraction or a predilection towards something that my creator has forbidden? He gave me that urge. All he told me is to resist the urge, not to get rid of the urge. Oh, there are such people, by the way, who do get rid of the urge. Our tradition speaks about the few of the proud, the tzaddikim. The Medrash says there are so few that when Hashem created the world, he planted just a few in throughout the spectrum of history. Just in every generation, he just planted a tzaddik or two. And these are the people who actually have no inclination. Like David HaMelech said that he had slain his evil inclination. So they have no inclination. If you want to do a test, a self-test, a home test, home tzaddik test, and see if you have no yetzer hara. So for some people, you know, this is a helpful thought exercise, because some of us are laboring under some misconceptions. So if you want to do a home test, if you're a tzaddik, what you do is, for 24 hours, any urge, any impulse that you become conscious of, immediately, without filtering it, without judging it, act upon it fully. And if after 24 hours nothing comes out but mitzvahs, you're a tzaddik. Most people couldn't last 30 seconds unless they, chained themselves to the radiator first. So there are such people. They have no evil inclination, and they don't need impulse control. They don't need to inhibit themselves because all of their impulses are godly. But that's a very, very rare and unusual condition. And I'm not a failure for not reaching that level. I should admire such people. I should emulate such people. But I'm not a failure for not being such a person. I'm not a failure for not ridding myself of my evil inclination. What I am a failure for is if I don't try, if I don't show up to the game, if I forfeit, and if I say, this is who I am, I want to be authentic, I want to be real, I'm keeping it real. No, I have to say to myself, look, there's a difference between who I am and what I do. Thank God. Who I am means the way my mind is wired. Well, there's two parts of who I am. I don't want to get into this at length, but just very briefly. Who I am, meaning my personality, what makes me me, is my wiring. And there's cognitive and emotional wiring. So the way my mind works, the way I process information, which is unique to anyone else in the world, because the sages tell us that ein de yesein shel b'nei adam shaves, that no two human beings, just like no two human beings, even identical twins, do not have the same facial features exactly. No two human beings have the same mind. So I have my unique wiring, cognitively, the way I perceive reality. And then emotionally I'm wired. And the emotional wiring is proportionate to the cognitive wiring. Which is why, for instance, children are emotionally hysterical, meaning they get elated about silly little things, and they get heartbroken also over silly little things. The reason that children are emotionally immature is because they are cognitively immature, because they intellectually they cannot perceive the relative triviality of whatever it is, and therefore it, for them, relatively speaking, it takes on great weight and great import, disproportionately so, and then they have this intense emotional reaction. But their emotional reaction is coming from the way they're cognitively wired. But at any rate, my point is, and we'll get into this more, about how the emotions really are an outgrowth of the intellect. It starts in the intellect, and then it becomes expressed emotionally. And then eventually behaviorally. But let's return to this in a moment. My point is that who I am, as opposed to what I do, who I am is my wiring. So my cognitive and my emotional wiring, the way that I process information and the way that I emotionally react to what I've processed. That's who I am. Okay. I don't have a whole lot of direct control over that. Then there's what I do. What I do, I have total control. So we would all agree that if we were sitting here talking and I tired of our conversation and the thought arose to me that a good way to end the conversation would be to take my cup of hot coffee and toss it in your face. By the way, if such a thought popped into my head, am I a terrible person? Thank you. It's a relief. I want to tell you something. I made up that example because it's a speech. If you heard the real examples, you wouldn't come to my speech. I'm not even joking. That's the thing. But you know what? I don't have to feel guilt over what kind of crazy things my Yetzirah makes me think of. That's its job. Its job is to make me think of crazy things. Cruel things, heretical things, disgusting things. That you can't take it so seriously. That's what it's supposed to do. Let it do its job. That's the thinking of, thinking of. Thinking of means, like back in the old days, in the 90s, when you go online and you have the pop-up ads, right? Now, pretty much, we don't get the pop-up ads so much. But remember the old days of surfing the net and you get the pop-up ads? And then, you know, the question would always be like, the pop-up ads sometimes are very unsavory, you know, just not very wholesome material there. So then the question becomes, well, I'm not a bad person. I didn't ask for this. I didn't ask for this schmutz to appear here. They put it on my screen. My job is to click it off. Now the question is, how quickly do I have to click it off? No, I'm getting there. The mouse is going, within the next few minutes, it's just, right? No, the answer is, how fast do I have to click off? You know, I know this is such an anachronistic example, but how fast am I morally obligated? How quickly am I morally obligated to click the red X and make the screen go away? As fast as is neurologically possible. That could be also. But then I wouldn't have an example. And then we'd have to talk about walking down the street or being allowed to live in Los Angeles. You don't want to go there. Okay. You don't mess with me, I won't mess with you. Okay. Why? Don't ask where I live, exactly. So thinking of is really automatic. It's a reflex. And we're not really given moral responsibility to govern what kinds of things we think of. As I mentioned, there are such people, very, very rare people, who only think of pure things. They're called tzaddikim. But a regular person, we think of all types of crazy stuff all the time. Okay. But then there's what I do. Now, I gave the example. If I'm sitting here and I'm getting bored. How do I get this conversation to end? I know. Right? Okay. Now, that was wrong. I couldn't help it. I'm sorry. I just couldn't help it. No, you could help it. You threw coffee in someone's face. Of course you could help it. No, something overtook me. Nothing overtook you. You made a choice. You are the balabos. You choose your behaviors. You chose a behavior. You threw coffee in that guy's face. That was not right. Okay, fine. All right. So we can all agree. My point is we can all agree that if I throw coffee in someone's face, that was a choice I made, and I am culpable for that. I am responsible for a behavior, for an action that I've taken. Yes? I mean, that's clear, right? Okay. All right. Let's say it's not an action. Let's say it's not an action. Let's say it's speech. Let's say we're sitting, we're talking, I'm getting bored, and I say to the person, I just want to tell you, this is the most boring conversation I ever had in my life. I don't care. I don't want to hear any more about your life. I didn't. What are you looking at me like that? I didn't throw coffee in the guy's face. So let's ask ourselves, if you speak to a person that way, is that wrong? I'm saying morally, is it wrong? Yeah, it's immoral. It's immoral. That's, What did he say? Why is it immoral? Why is it immoral? Yeah, that's not nice.
It may not be nice, but it's pretty dramatic.
It's not nice. So let me tell you something. I have ways of getting off the phone that don't require hurting anyone's feelings. But I don't want to squabble about this. My point is, okay, so let's make it a more obvious example. So I'm sitting there, and I don't want to talk to someone anymore, and I say, by the way, I don't like you, no one likes you, no one ever will. Can we agree that that's wrong, that that's not a nice way to speak? Okay. But it's just words. I'm just talking. We're just talking here. No. You hurt somebody. Don't get hung up on the examples. By the way, I found, I hate this. I really, to communicate concepts, we need to use metaphors. Because when we're talking about something deep, we can't go straight to it. So we use a metaphor to talk about it a notch or two lower. And it's always the occupational hazard that when you use metaphors or examples, when people get hung up on the details of the metaphor. So one of the, for instance, Jews, the way we learn, Talmudic learning, is we use case studies all the time. But the case studies are to establish legal principles. And if you get hung up on the details of the case and you don't see the big picture, you don't see the forest for the trees and realize that really the sugya is discussing a legal principle, an abstract concept, not a very specific case. And the case is just a tool for understanding the principle at hand. So then you can't really learn Gemara. You can't learn Talmud properly. So just remember, when I'm talking to you right now, the examples are just for the sake of arriving at principles. And at each interval, you can ask yourself, what principles are we talking about here? So, like, for instance, let me just pause for a second. What principles are we talking about here? I'm not talking about coffee being thrown in people's faces or saying mean things to people. Those are silly examples that I'm using to keep you awake. What's the principle we're discussing? And don't say how to rewire your brain, because that's the name of the entire talk. No, I'm saying for the last 5 minutes, what was the principle? Okay. But you got ahead of me. You saw where I'm. You got ahead of me. You said to control what we do, meaning action. Don't throw the coffee in someone's face. That's not nice. To control what you say. Don't tell them, I don't like you. No one likes you. No one ever will. It's not nice. But now let's take it up. Let's take it one more level. Let's up the ante. What about thinking? What about thinking? But I'm going to make a condition here. Not thinking of, thinking about. I'm going to say it again. Not thinking of, thinking about. So what if I'm sitting there and I'm thinking the whole time not nice thoughts? I'm thinking of them. They pop up and then I push them away and I say, this is not a productive thought. That's fine, right? That was like, oh, that's a parking spot. Oh, no, it's a driveway. And then you drive away. But what if I am sitting there and I decide, you know, I would never do this. Remember yesterday we had I gave a talk about resentment, about letting go of old hurt. I think that's a good example of, in fact, it's interesting, Vashkocha Pratis, this week's Ami magazine, the Rosh Hashanah issue, which I believe is on the newsstands now, or it will be tomorrow or very soon, somebody wrote me a question whether or not as a therapeutic practice that victims of abuse should fantasize about revenge on their abuser. And you can find out what I wrote. You can pay the $3.95 or whatever. Come on, guys. You don't know my style. You can't guess what I would have said. Guess. What do you think I said? Don't do it. Okay, you're only hurting yourself. Don't do it. Okay, if you want more details, you pay $3.95. Okay. So I don't make commission. Don't worry about it. At any rate, so if I sit down and I say to myself, I'm now going to fantasize about something that morally I would never do, morally I would never say. But if I just want to sit and imagine myself doing it, who am I harming? So can we, but what if I say, okay, you're right, it's not good, but I can't control it. First of all, are we clear on, do we have a consensus on, do I control, am I responsible for whether or not I sit and fantasize about something? Yes. I am culpable. I am responsible. Okay, fine. even though I might argue, but I haven't done anything. Well, yeah, actually you have done something. But I didn't. I didn't do an action. I didn't say any speech. I'm just thinking a thought. But the point is that thought is also a type of behavior. Thought is also something that you control. Imagine if I would ask you to think the times tables in your head. Just do the times tables. Don't say it out loud. Just think times tables in your head. And because nobody else is listening, you don't have to be fancy. You could do like easy ones, like 2 times 3 is 6 and 2 times 4 is 8. And like, okay, let's do. Yeah, please.
Just a reminder for those parked in the front, at 11 o'clock, we have to feed the meters. So anybody has a car, please, if you can do that, that'd be save you some negative impulses later.
That was great. Okay, so times tables. Okay, let's do it for 30 seconds. Times tables in your head starting now. If any other thoughts arise to your mind, don't worry about it. Just do times tables through it. Just push through it and do times tables. I'm doing it as well. And I'm doing a fancy one. I just did 12 times 11, by the way, just so you know. Not that I'm showing off. Okay, everybody's doing it? Okay, we can stop. All right. All right, so everybody did it, right? All right. So the first thing I want to point out is that everybody was comfortable with my idiom when I asked, did everybody do it? Nobody, and I know this is a crowd that's not afraid to speak up, nobody said, I didn't do anything. I've been sitting here the whole time. Everyone was comfortable with my describing a mental exercise as doing. Are you doing it? Yeah, I did it. I did it. It wasn't a physical action. It wasn't verbal speech. It was thought, but you were okay when I asked you, did you do it? And you knew exactly what I meant. That's the first point I want to make. Second point is, I want to ask you a question. You were thinking the times tables a minute ago? Okay. Were you thinking times tables an hour ago? No, not unless you happen to be like a third grade math teacher who just came from work on a Sunday. Did you know the times tables an hour ago? So you can know something and not be thinking it. Knowing is part of who you are. The technical term is das. Das is one of the keiches hanefesh. In other words, it's the hardware. Thinking, the technical term in Hasidic terminology, is a levush or a behavior. It's part of the software. It's software that you're running. Now, you plug in your intellect into your thought, but intellect's the hardware, thought is the software. Intellect is your wiring. It's who you are. I can't help it. I'm the kind of guy who sees driveways and I think parking spot. That's just who I am. But it doesn't mean that has to be what I do. I get to choose my behavior, meaning my physical action, my behavior as verbal speech, and I even get to choose my behavior as willful thought. Now, where this figures prominently, well, there are two ways. First of all, let's talk about the fact that I knew the times tables an hour ago, and I knew the times tables 10 years ago, but I wasn't thinking the times tables. First, let's just clarify the good news here, which is, you know, there are certain things that, you know, people say, well, that, you know, that's it. You're ruined. You can't unknow that. You can't unsee that. once you've tasted that, you've experienced that, that's it. You're done.
What was the word you said?
For what? I said a bunch of words.
Ruin.
Yeah. That basically you have an experience or knowledge or, you know, like Adam and Eve. They acquired knowledge, and it changed everything. After that point, it just corrupted reality. In their case, subjective reality was reflected objectively, and we're dealing with the aftermath of that. But the point is that they gained this knowledge, and you can't unknow it once you know it. So the question is, you know, not that you should go out and tarnish your innocence, but I'm saying b'dyavad, after the fact. Once you found out, see, if you were innocent and you never knew that, I will use the example of my dear friend and mentor, Rabbi Josh Gordon, Olav HaShalom. If you never knew that seven-layer cake was so delicious, if you remained innocent, and you'd seen seven-layer cake, you'd heard about it, you read about it in an article somewhere, but you never experienced it, right? And then one day you tasted seven-layer cake, and now you know what it tastes like. Ooh. And you can't unknow it now. Now that you know it, you can't take that out of the files. It became part of the hardware. To the extent that when you see the seven-layer cake, you will have knowledge of what it tastes like to eat it based on your experience. And seven-layer cake is a euphemism. For what? I'm not going to say publicly. You can use your own imagination. I don't want to make it worse than it already is. The point is that I know about seven-layer cake. I tasted it. It's done. I can't get that back. I can't regain that innocence of never having tasted seven-layer cake. But that doesn't mean that it has to be a part of my life today. Not in action, not in speech, and not even in thought. So I can have knowledge of things that I wish I didn't have knowledge of. I mean, basically, that's the story of Adam and Eve, and it's the story of each individual, is the loss of innocence, becoming corrupted, finding out, you know, gaining knowledge of what you wish you never had knowledge of. But that cannot hurt me if I don't act on it, I don't speak about it, and I don't fantasize about it. In fact, not only will it not hurt me just to know about it, it won't even hurt me to think of it. In fact, once my Yetzer Hara knows about seven-layer cake, it may come to me at strategic times in the middle of Shemena Esra and say, hey, I got something to think about. And I'm going to say, no, that's not what we're thinking about. When can we think about seven-layer cake? Never. We're not going to think about that. Now, I've thought of it. By definition, I've thought of it. But I'm choosing, and I can't choose whether or not I've thought of it, but I'm choosing not to think about it. There's a story. A Jew came to the Mezitcha Magid, and he told him he has trouble with stray thoughts, that he's beset by all types of distracting thoughts, and he wants to know how to get rid of them. So the Magid told him that you should go to my Talmid, to my disciple Reb Zev in Jitomir, and Reb Zev will help you with stray thoughts. So this Jew shows up in Jitomir, a town where he's never been before. He doesn't know anyone there, and it happens to be Erev Shabbos. And he asks around, in those days they didn't have addresses, he asks around, where does Reb Zev live? So finally somebody points out, that's the house. It's Friday afternoon, he hears a hustle and bustle inside the house, clearly a family getting ready for Shabbos, he knocks on the door, and nobody answers. Well, maybe they're distracted, maybe it's so busy and loud they don't hear, he knocks on the door, and no answer. He knocks on the door, And it's getting closer and closer to Shabbos. He has his things with him. He has to put them down somewhere so that he doesn't carry on Shabbos. And he's knocking, and nobody's coming to the door. And finally, it's just a few minutes before sunset. He has no choice. He takes his things. He goes to shul. He puts his stuff down in shul. And that's where he stays with the other homeless in shul. He eats and he sleeps in shul for Shabbos. So after Shabbos, Rebzev comes over to him. Augustin Shtot, you know, a new face. Who are you? He says, I came from your Rebbe, from the Magid. Oh, very good. Come to my house. Comes to his house, Matzah Shabbos, Havdalah, Malava Malka. Very, very, very nice, very, a Torah discussion. And he feels like, you know, this Rebzev is clearly a very good teacher. He's a very kind person. And it's just very incongruous to me, the fact that Erev Shabbos, I know he heard me knocking. There's no way he didn't hear me knocking. How did he ignore that? It just seems out of character. So the fellow says, listen, Rebzev, I really have to ask. Erev Shabbos, I came to your house and I was knocking. I know you heard me. I know. And you didn't come to the door, and I ended up homeless for Shabbos. I was sleeping in shul. And I don't think that's right, even though you're treating me very nicely right now. But the Magid sent me to you. You understand? The Magid sent me to you. You're supposed to teach me how to manage stray thoughts. So Rebzev says, yeah. Well, that's the first thing I taught you as soon as you arrived in town. Just because there's a knock at the door doesn't mean I open it. So what was Rebzev teaching him? There's a teaching even before that. What? They expect what? What do they expect? Oh. There's something even more basic than that. There's this neurotic obsession with being knock-free. Oh my God, I had a knock at the door. So? I was in the middle of Shemini Esrei and I thought of seven-layer cake. All right, and then what? No, that's it. I just thought of it. And so are we. We are well prepared for the fact that there is a built-in mechanism called the Yetzer Hara, whose entire job is to harass the hell out of you from the inside. By making you think of all types of things that seem enticing, that seem pleasurable, that seem important. Sometimes it comes to you, this is a very important thing. We got to figure this out right now. This is very urgent. And it's just a knock at the door. It's just a knock at the door. Now we get, oh no, we had a knock at the door. Welcome to humanity. You had a knock at the door. Right, so like George Bush said, or George W. Bush said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you can't fool me again. Remember that? You remember that? That was one of the all-time YouTube clips. There's a saying, if you fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But George Bush said, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you can't fool me again. Anyways, you check it out on YouTube. It was very eloquent. So you're right. You know, sometimes we do open the door because the guy sounded so sincere. He really seemed sincere. And then he comes in, and within a half an hour, he's wearing your pajamas. This is not a house guest. What are you doing? You're kicking me out. And we learn our lesson.
That's the
notification of how false is the same. Mm-hmm. The phones? Yeah. You're just mentioning the phones. The phones are just an extension of it. But, you know, we had it before the phones because the Yetzer Hara was not invented with phones. In fact, Pirkei Avos says a guy is walking down the path and he says, "What a beautiful tree." So, like 2,000 years ago, it wasn't like, "Oh, let me check my WhatsApp." It was like, "Oh, what a beautiful tree." It's the same mechanism. The point is, I shouldn't use that example. You know why? Because nobody here is going to recognize the weakness of will involved in saying, "What a beautiful tree." Everyone's going to think that was a nice thing, and then it's going to confuse everybody. And then I'm going to have to spend 20 minutes explaining why somebody who is involved in Torah thought should not be saying, "Oh, what a beautiful tree." So forget that. Strike that from the record. The jury should disregard that last statement. Okay. Yes. No, the point is that some examples require so much explanation, they cease being examples. You need examples for the examples.
What about
incessant knocking? And the Tanya tells us in chapter 27 that the knock itself is nothing to be ashamed of. In fact, it tells us there's a mitzvah, one of the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah, that you cannot perform unless you get knocks. It says tzaddikim can't do this mitzvah. It's called leisasudu acharei levavchem v'acharei neichem. Do not go straying after your heart and after your eyes. A tzaddik cannot do that mitzvah because he doesn't have, remember we spoke about the person who has no evil impulse. So this is a mitzvah. You can when you get the knock, the mitzvah, it's a mitzvah, so say it's a negative, it's a prohibition. It means when you get the knock, don't answer it. But you can only not answer it if there's a knock. So the Alter Rebbe says, even if his kol yomov, all of his days will be incessant knocking, and people say, "I can't function, I would go insane." Well, I want to tell you something. You will not go insane. You will be fine. You will be a productive and happy member of society. You will serve Hashem with joy, even if it is knocking all the time. It is not an excuse. It is not an excuse. Once you get over the fact that there's no shame in having the knock, it becomes a whole lot easier to deal with it. It's like when you live in New York and you don't even hear car alarms anymore. You can live with annoyance. Yeah, it is annoying. It is annoying. But let me ask you something. When you found out, whatever age you were, that basically you're here to serve Hashem and service is going to involve challenge and it's going to involve overcoming obstacles. Once you realize that that's what life's about, it's about the challenge. Overcoming annoyance, that's par for the course. Yeah, what else would I expect? Life is a struggle. Part of that struggle is this jerk, who's me, who uses my own voice. He's so convincing because he's on the other side of the door and he has my voice. He sounds like, "This is very important. Open the door." And he sounds like me. And I really want to open the door, but I'm not going to, fool me twice, shame on you. So I'm not going to go. I'm not going to open the door because I know what listen, it's extremely essential that we think about seven-layer cake right now. And no, it's not. It's not. Okay. So the first thing I wanted to say with the times tables exercise, that we were thinking times tables, now it's about 15 minutes ago. We were thinking times tables 15 minutes ago, but we were not thinking times tables an hour ago, even though we knew the times tables an hour ago. The point is that you can know something that you wish you didn't know, and it won't hurt you. As long as you're not running the software, as long as you're not choosing to think about it, you are safe. Even if not only you know it, but you think of it. Even if you think of it, it also won't hurt you. In fact, every time you think of it and refuse to think about it, you're doing a mitzvah, which is connecting to you to Hashem. So every time you get a knock and you just go about your business, you think of but don't think about, you're actually connected to Hashem. You're actively connecting yourself through the act of a mitzvah. Now, people say, I don't want that mitzvah. I want a more glorious mitzvah. I want a more pristine mitzvah. But we don't get to choose our mitzvah opportunities. The Eibishter chooses them for us. So that's the first thing, is you should know that there's all types of stuff. Like yesterday, the talk about resentment, you know, there is that museum of resentments, of suffering. Okay, that museum exists. It's not like you'll ever bulldoze the museum. If whoever wasn't here yesterday, just roll with it. But we're talking about how in our minds we construct this elaborate museum with these exhibits to our own trauma, and that sometimes we go into our heads and we revisit it and we experience a resentment, which is a resentiment. It's not happening now, but we're re-feeling it now. And I mentioned yesterday how that's a meditation. Because meditation is focusing on an abstract concept so with such focus that you actually produce an emotional reaction. I mean, there are different definitions of meditation, but specifically Chassidic, or I should say probably more specifically Chabad Chassidic meditation, is to focus on an abstract concept with such focus until you produce an emotional reaction. And I would even add one more clause, which then leads to behavior. At any rate, so, you know, the museum, one second, I'll finish the sentence and I'm going to get to you, is the museum, you're not going to bulldoze the museum. That place, that dangerous place in your mind, it will always exist. And in fact, sometimes that museum will send flyers. We have a new exhibit. We've hired you, right? And that's called thinking of. All that toxic stuff, it's there. It can't hurt you. It won't hurt you. As long as you don't open the door and say, all right, let's now willfully engage this on the level of active thought. Let's meditate on it. Because then what starts happening, once we start thinking about it, then it does start hurting us. Okay, yeah, what was the question?
Can you tell us the emotions too? Like you stir up the wall, and then after some time you feel something. How bad? When you feel emotions, what kind of emotions?
What kind of emotions? Well, there are really only two emotions, love and fear. Everything else is a derivative of love or fear. Love is what I want, and fear is what I don't want.
So meditation
Oh, so we didn't even get to that. So far, we didn't even get to producing emotions that we want. So far, all we've been talking about is stop producing the emotions you don't want. So just to recap, and then we should shift into producing the emotions that we do want. Yeah. Yes. No emotion comes from it if you push it away. That's the point. If you don't push it away and you run the fantasy, then you will produce emotions. So let's say you go to the museum and you revisit your trauma. You will produce feelings of, well, basically, is that a feeling of love or fear? Fear. And if we're going to get more specific, we might say victimhood, we might say sadness, grief, loss, frustration, anger, but really the main rubric there is fear. Or let's say seven-layer cake, you know, and I go visit that and I start fantasizing about how, oh, God forbid, I would never actually do that. That would be disgusting. But, you know, I just want to sit and think about it, you know, privacy of my own home here, you know, and it's, right? What? You're talking about the previous thing. I already switched. I'm talking too fast in order to... Okay, so let me stop. Let me park. Let me go back. Avelis is a pre-programmed structure for going through those... for that cognitive, emotional process. It gives it a framework so that it comes to an end. So it has a target and it has a structure rather than being never ending. The purpose of it having an amount of time is so it will have an end. All right, let me go. That's also a very important point. Yesterday we spoke about the difference between pain and suffering. I think it's negated to this discussion as well, so I'll bring it back and I'll try to do it as quickly as possible. But pain is similar to thinking of, but even more so, because thinking of is internal. Pain is a response to something external, to stimulus. But both of them could be emotional pain just as well. It doesn't have to be physical pain. It could also be emotional pain. Emotional pain is also a response to stimulus. Emotional pain is an objective thing. Yeah, it's not imagined. It's not in your mind. Yeah, emotional pain is real, for sure, just like physical pain. But the pain means the actual feeling of the wound. What's not pain? I don't want to get into the fine line where we transition from pain to suffering. Let's give an exaggerated example in order to make it more easy to deal with. It's 10 years later. The pain is clearly over, but my resentment is stronger than ever. So now it's not pain anymore. It's not a stimulus response. Because remember, the stimulus response God gave me as a survival mechanism to help keep me safe. So if I touch the stove and it hurts, it's to keep me from burning my hand. If somebody is emotionally hurting me, it's to keep me safe. I'm supposed to register that's not a safe person. I'm supposed to get away from them and avoid further interactions with them. But now it's 10 years later and I'm 3,000 miles away. That person's not in my life. They can't hurt me anymore. Let's pretend that's the example. And I'm driving down the 405 and I'm having I'm full of rage and anger and grief about something that not only it's not happening now, but my emotions are completely the product of my own meditation. My emotions are not here and now based. They're a product of a meditation. In this case, a resentment meditation. I mentioned it yesterday, and I'll just mention it again very quickly, then I want to get back on track. The flip side of the resentment meditation, and again, I want to get into the positive thinking for the positive emotions that we do want, because I didn't even touch that yet. But you want to talk about the avoiding the negative thought patterns that produce negative emotions. So the flip side of the resentment meditation is the fear meditation. Resentment meditation is recalling the past and creating emotions now. Fear meditation is imagining the future and creating emotions now. Yeah, so the resentment meditation is I'm recalling the past, which by this at this point is totally subjective. I mean, the more that I've revisited, the more it becomes embellished. Or more, let's say, the more subjective it becomes. So the resentment meditation is I'm recalling the past and I'm creating emotions now. So the emotions I'm creating are now, but they're not based on now. They're based on the past. That's resentment. And then the fear meditation is I'm imagining the future, because fear is always about something that's going to happen. Worry, anxiety, dread, they're all fear. So I'm imagining the future, and I'm creating an emotional reaction now. And again, just like with resentment, my emotions now are not really based on the circumstances now. So another way of saying it, the common denominator between the resentment meditation and the fear meditation is that they're not reality-based, or they take me out of reality, or they divorce me from the moment. And yeah. Yeah, yeah, fear or meditation, they take me out of the moment. And what's so terrible about that is that all my power is in the moment. The freedom of choice is in the moment. I can't choose what I did a minute ago. I've done it. I can't choose what I'm going to do a minute from now. I haven't done it yet. I can choose what I do right now. Right. And which is why during that period there's nothing to do. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so that question, I'll just rearticulate it in my own words, is I'm reacting to something now, but it's really not now. It's about what now reminds me of. Which, by the way, is pretty much every painful interaction that we have, is I'm not so much responding to what you did or what you're doing to me right now, as much as what it reminds me of. So, when we stop being resentful people, when we stop revisiting our suffering or reviving our suffering, a side benefit of that is we also become more pain-free with the stuff that's going on now. You understand what I'm saying? Is if I'm nursing old hurt, and that's something I keep fresh, I keep those wounds fresh by meditating on them, and then I have an interaction in the present which reminds me of it, obviously now, you know, poking a fresh wound is a lot more painful than touching a scar. Now, there will always be a scar, and I have to know that that's my weakness. So I know, for instance, sometimes, you know, somebody will say something to me, and it hurts me a lot more than it should because that's where my scar is. But I'm aware of my scar, and I'm aware that this is affecting me disproportionately. And I can sort of cognitively, I can override it, I can take control, I can tell myself, I can narrate to myself, the feeling you're having right now, Chase, is disproportionate to what's happening. And I can do that if I have a scar. But if I keep my wound fresh because I keep going back to it, then it's very hard to do that cognitive override. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to get to the positive, but these people are dragging me down. Oh, I wasn't supposed to. Can I tell you something, by the way, about human nature? Everybody thinks they want to hear positive, but I'm pointing it out because it's a valuable insight. If I wouldn't say at some point, can we stop talking about the negative and talk about what we do want to do? Like, it's human nature. People will sit and talk about the problem forever. I'm not saying this is indicative of this group. It's human nature. We talk about the negative, I'm pointing it out because it's a valuable insight, and we have to be aware of it, and to be aware of it and to tell ourselves, I'm allowed to talk. Okay, I have a problem. I want to be responsible. I want to deal with the problem. I'm giving myself 5 minutes. Give yourself an hour, whatever you want. I'm setting a timer for talking about the problem. Because if you don't set a time, we never get to proactive solutions. Okay. About the problem? Okay, let's, yeah?
I love and fear. I love and fear. Is there a situation that you can imagine where love and fear are completely intertwined?
Are there situations where love and fear can happen at the same time, or they can be co-inclusive? Yeah, sure. I mean, we're commanded to both love God and be in awe of God. So being in love with God means we want to be close to Him, as close as possible. Being in awe of God means we're overwhelmed and we need to take a step back. And we're supposed to have both of those emotions at the same time. God, being infinite, can evoke within us infinite-like emotions. So we're able to have two opposites paradoxically at the same time. No, outside of our relationship with God, we cannot have love and fear simultaneously. We can toggle back and forth. I love you. I hate you. Not simultaneously. Sadness and joy. Sadness and joy, also we tend to fluctuate. In our relationship with Hashem, we can feel sadness and joy at the same time. But yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Right, that's true. But, I mean, I don't want to get off into this tangent, but you can love a person and be afraid of what they do. They're two different things. It's much simpler in life if you love people and love everything they do, or you can just fear them and fear what they do, and then it's much simpler that way if it's consistent. Problem is that life is interesting, and there's people we fear, but we love what they do, and there's people we love, and we fear what they do. That's what makes life complicated. At any rate, okay, so I can know something. I can even think of something, and it's not going to affect me as long as I don't think about it. I didn't even explain why that's so. I didn't even explain the mechanics of that. I alluded to it, but I didn't explain it. I alluded to it much, much earlier when I said that the emotions are an outgrowth of cognition. You become... See, emotions are by definition reactive. An emotion is a reaction. An emotional reaction is almost redundant. Emotions are reactions to what? Cognition. To your mind. Emotions are not reactions to stimulus, by the way. Pain and pleasure are reactions directly to stimulus. That's why they're uncontrollable. Emotions are reactions to what's going on in your mind. So what I think about my pain or what I think about my pleasure will create an emotion. Don't confuse pain and pleasure with emotions. I think this is an important point, by the way. Pain and pleasure are not sadness and joy. Sadness and joy are emotional states, which are uniquely human. Pain and pleasure are... reflex reactions, which are felt by animals as well. And you can see this from the fact that there's no amount of pleasure that will ever amount to one iota of joy. You can stuff yourself full of pleasure, and it will never hit a critical mass where that amount of pleasure equals joy. And conversely, being in pain doesn't have to mean that you're sad. You can be in pain and happy. They're not contradictory at all. And you can actually be feeling pleasure and be very sad at the same time, because they're not the same thing. So emotions are a reaction to cognition, to what I am thinking, how I am processing information, how I'm processing data up here. That's where my emotions come from. Hence, when I do a resentment, and I reprocess trauma, so I'm going to have emotions that are, you know, it's like a mill. If you put wheat in the mill, what kind of flour are you going to get? Wheat flour. If you put barley in the mill, what kind of flour are you going to get? Barley flour. Excellent. Okay. So if I put resentment meditations into the mill, what kind of emotions am I going to get? Victimhood, rage, helplessness, fear. Whatever you put in from the cognition side is what you're going to get out on the emotional side. And it doesn't matter what it is. It could be... So I'll give you an example. I'll give you a very silly example. I was once talking to a group of children of Shluchim at a camp. These were all little kids from 8 years old till 12 years old. And actually, the whole story is like this, in 30 seconds. I was writing a book on Shaarei Yichud VeEmunah of Tanya, which is about the oneness of God. And it was taking me years to finish it. And I had a publisher who was pressing me that I had a deadline. So my wife sent me for a 10-day writer's retreat in the desert in Arizona, where they had the Tzirei HaShluchim camp. These are all little kids who are children of Shluchim. They live mostly in far-flung areas. And so for 10 days, I was there. And I told them, listen, I'm not there to talk to the kids. I don't want to talk to the kids. I'm here to write. They said, no problem. You can write. So the last day, they say, will you talk to the kids? I said, I'm not a kid guy. That's not me. And they said, come on. Let's talk to the kids. I said, not only am I not a kid guy, but for the past 10 days, I've been immersed in Shaarei Yichud VeEmunah, which is this deep, abstruse text about the oneness and unity of God. I'm not in a mode to, you know, play camp counselor. They said, don't worry, you could talk to the kids about whatever you want. So I get up there, and what was on my mind? Shaarei Yichud VeEmunah. So how does it begin? Shaarei Yichud VeEmunah begins. It's a pasuk. It's a verse from Deuteronomy. You should know today and should place upon your heart. So knowing is one thing. Placing upon your heart is another. You should know today, you should place upon your heart. That's like, you know the times tables. Placing it upon your heart means, okay, think about it now. So I asked them, I didn't ask them times tables, but I asked them, imagine you're in Crown Heights for a Shabbos. These are little kids who are like, from all sorts of far-flung areas, they don't have kosher restaurants. They don't have Pico Robertson. More kosher restaurants on one street on Pico than in the entire world. So, for them, a kosher restaurant is a rarity. So I said to them, imagine you're in Crown Heights for Shabbos, and it's right after Shabbos, and your older brother is holding the cell phone. He says, I'm going to order food for us, and we have to choose milchiks or fleishiks, which in Crown Heights means pizza or fake Chinese food. So that's milchiks or fleishiks, pizza or Chinese. And they're going around, taking a vote, pizza or Chinese, pizza or Chinese, pizza or Chinese. And they come to you, and you say, give me a minute. Why do you need a minute? I need to think. I need to figure out what I want. You need to figure out what you want. You're that out of touch with your feelings. I'm not asking you what I want. I'm asking you, what do you want? You don't know what you want. No, I need a minute to think. Why should a person need a minute to figure out what they want? And yet, you do need a minute. But it doesn't make sense that you should need a minute to figure out what you want. And the explanation is you don't use the minute to figure out what you want. You use the minute in order to want. If you wanted it, you'd know it. You're not figuring out what you want. You're getting yourself to want. In other words, I know about pizza. I've known about pizza since the first time I tasted pizza. I created a special file for pizza. It is there. Everywhere I go, it is there. I've been to Australia, I've been to South Africa. Everywhere I go, the pizza file comes with me. Doesn't mean I thought about pizza in all those places, but it's there. It's part of me. Okay. And, the Chinese food. I also have a file for that. Okay, I know about pizza. I know about Chinese. But I don't have any particular feeling right now. It's just abstract. I know about it. Give me a minute. Give me a minute. Okay. 30 seconds, I'm going to meditate on pizza. 30 seconds, I'm going to meditate on Chinese food. And at the end of the minute, I say, I feel like pizza. We say it, I feel like pizza. In other words, I knew about pizza, but I wasn't feeling like pizza. So what did I have to do to get myself from knowing about it as an abstraction to actually feeling something about it in the present moment? What was the bridge between knowing about it and having a feeling for it? I mean, all the answers are correct. I would use the simplest word, which is thinking. You can call it meditating, you can call it visualizing, you can call it whatever you want, but it's thinking. And thinking, thinking is an activity, albeit an activity that I engage in my own head. But it's an activity, which I have control over. So my point is, just like I can know about harmful stuff, resentments, fears, lusts, and they come to me, let's think about it, and I can say, no, you might be able to make me think of it all my life, but I will not think about it. No, I will not answer the door. And we're safe from the damage of those toxic thoughts that would create toxic emotions. We'll just flip it. Now, just flip it. There's all this great stuff, this healing stuff, this wonderful, holy information that I know about and would have a profound effect on me emotionally and then consequently behaviorally as well. If one thing, though, it's not enough to know about it, what do I have to do? Think about it. So I say to this group of little Shluchim's kids, I ask them, what would you do if your little brother, your little five-year-old brother would ask you, where is God? So what do you think they said? They were Lubavitcher kids. What do you think they said? Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Yes, God is everywhere. By the way, I was speaking at a Chabad house in Northern California. You're familiar with that state? And it was actually at UC Davis. And there was someone there who was a professor of developmental psychology. And I told this story. And she told me later, she said, by the way, children don't have, a five-year-old doesn't have the concept of omnipresence. If you ask a child where God is, they'll say in heaven or in the synagogue. But they won't say everywhere. I said, but that's the story I'm telling you. I asked a room full of kids. They said everywhere. She's like, not really possible. So, you know, like one of these Chabad on campus Chabad houses where the Chabad house is the house where the Shluchim live. So it happened to be that, you know, it's exciting. You have a speaker in the Chabad house. So the kids were, it was like 10 p.m., but the kids are still awake and running around. So there was this little five-year-old kid. And I said to him, hey, how old are you? And he says, 5. I said, perfect, get over here. I said to him, where's Hashem? He said, everywhere. By the way, what's the point of that? The point of that, of telling you the story is, and this is a story within a story, and I'm already 30 seconds over time, so I'm going to wrap up. But the point of telling you the story is, I'm sure she's right. I'm sure developmentally that five-year-olds don't understand the concept of everywhere. But I believe that when children are taught chassidus from a young age, they can. That when we speak the language of infinity, of omnipresence, of spirituality, of something that's bigger than just space and time, it does expand children's minds, and they can think in those terms.
Time to save Eve, yeah.
So, I am over time, right?
No.
We're supposed to Okay, but I'm gonna make a goal to finish in 5 minutes. Let's finish in 5 minutes here. Okay. So I asked these kids, if your little 5-year-old sibling asks you, where is Hashem? And you're going to say, everywhere. Okay, so I said, great, that's fine. How do you feel about the fact that Hashem is everywhere? Now, they had a hard time with that question. It was a new question. It was a new formulation. How do I feel about the fact? I want to tell you something. It's not because they're children. It's... when I ask this question from adults, I have an even harder time. To the extent that I had to learn that if I ask adults, where's Hashem? And they say, Hashem's everywhere. And then I lead them to that answer. And then I'll say, how do you feel about it? Adults will not answer that question. So I learned a trick. It seems so silly, but I'll tell you what it is. So if I'm talking to adults, I say, if a person were to have a feeling about Hashem being everywhere, what types of feelings might they have? And then adults will do it, because then it's safe. Then it's safe. It's just this theoretical, hypothetical guy having feelings. No one's really having feelings here. Don't worry. No one's getting vulnerable. Don't worry. But anyways, with children who are more vulnerable, so I was able to ask them directly, if you were to have feelings, what feelings would you have? So, I don't know. So I said, okay. Well, think about the pizza and the Chinese. You know about pizza. You know about Chinese. But you don't feel about any of them in particular. And what did you have to do to go from knowing to feeling? Thinking, okay? And like we spent 90% of our time talking about, when we think about negative stuff and toxic stuff, we create negative, toxic emotions. Well, let's just flip it, the same exact thing. If we think about holy things and unwholesome things, then we'll have holy and wholesome emotions. So here's the thing. We know lots of information that would really, really profoundly affect us, that would profoundly affect us if we were to think about it. This is why I always say, I'm going to be careful how I say this, that learning chassidus will actually not help you on its own. Thinking about what you've learned in chassidus will change your life. The shame is when a person comes Monday night and they spend an hour and 15 minutes, and then it's over, and then they run to the car and they turn on the radio. You spent an hour and 15 minutes learning, but the learning doesn't change you. It's thinking about what you've learned. So instead, do something really crazy. Even though it's LA and nobody walks, but even on a Monday night, it's not even Shabbos, walk to the Monday night class, walk home from the Monday night class, don't be in the car where you're going to turn on the radio, don't take out your phone and check your text messages, walk home from the class and talk to yourself, discursive thought. See, this is how meditation is so different in our tradition than other traditions where they try to empty the mind and they banish discursive thought. Jewish meditation is dafke, discursive thought. It's called hisbeinonos for a reason, because the word there is bina. Bina means elaboration. So in other words, ask yourself, what was the main point that the rabbi said in the class? Okay, now let me say that one point back to myself in 10 different ways that are original to my own style of thinking. That's called hisbeinonos. That's meditation. And you do that for your 10-minute walk. Those 10 minutes, even if you have a 5-minute walk, those 5 minutes, those will change your life. So I ask the little kids, I say, okay, you know that Hashem is everywhere. Great. How do you feel about it? We don't feel anything. I said, no problem. I didn't really actually expect you to feel anything about it. How could you feel about it if you haven't yet thought about it? So here's what I want to do. For 1 minute, for 60 seconds, let's just think about it. And that's what we did. For 60 seconds, we thought about it. So after 60 seconds, I said, okay, now that we've thought about Hashem being everywhere. And by the way, let me make it clear. You don't have to think about how it makes you feel. That's not what you do. You just think about it, and you will automatically feel. That's why Kabbalistically, you know, the process of thinking is likened to the marital union. It's just, you know, children are born when the parents unite. So when the Chochmah and the Bina get together through Das, the Midos, the emotions, are the children. They're automatically born. So you don't have to think, what does this make me feel? Just think about the idea in your own words, in your own thoughts. Okay, so we did this for a minute. And after the minute passes, so I say to the kids, okay, what kind of feelings? You know, somebody tell me what feeling you had. So the first kid who volunteered, he happened to be in the front row on the very left side. I said, how did you feel? So he said, I felt happy. Okay, great. Somebody else, how did you feel? So the kid next to him says, I felt safe. Great, fantastic. I was done. Two guys answered, two examples, I was done, that's it. But the kids thought we were going around, because the first kid who answered was the front row on the left side, and the next kid was the one right after him. So they thought we were going around, and everyone was supposed to say it. It was a room of like 75 kids. And once I realized they were going, I couldn't cut it off. So I just let it go. And I felt happy, I felt safe, I felt calm. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, if we could bottle this and sell it to the pharmaceutical industry, we would be billionaires. Happy, safe, calm. And the irony is that we would be billionaires, and we'd be selling something to people that even a child can produce with their own mind for free. And the thing is, though, no one's going to do it. The other day, last week, I was in Manhattan, downtown, and there was this program there for young Jewish professionals. And the format was that I was having a discussion with a manager of a multi-billion dollar hedge fund. And I don't remember how it got onto the topic, but I asked him, could you disclose a little bit of your investment strategy? So he says, I'll disclose my entire investment strategy, which surprised me. And he said, listen, my investment strategy is not a secret. I'll tell everyone my investment strategy, and they're not going to do it. It's like somebody just told me the other day. Pirkei Avos says, Syog l'chochma shsika. That if you're quiet, it's a safeguard for wisdom. But isn't that dangerous information? A fool is going to find that out. And then what he's going to do is just be silent, and everyone's going to think he's wise. So it's giving him an unfair advantage, that the fool is going to find out. All he has to do is be silent, and everyone's going to think, wrongfully, is going to think that he's wise, he's going to fool everybody. So why is Pirkei Avos allowing the fool to have this information? And the answer is, the fool's never going to do it. He knows it'll work. Everyone will think he's smart, and he can't help himself. He's not going to do it. So my point is like this. This is the final 30 seconds here. We all know, and if you don't know, go do some more research. Try it out. That when we answer the knock of the toxic thoughts, the resentments, the fears, the lusts, all the negative stuff, it's just dehumanizing and destructive. When we allow that to become a fantasy, we know we end up feeling like garbage. We know it. We've proven that to ourselves, okay? And then conversely, if you'll take a wholesome thought, a holy thought, something that you learn in Chassidus, and I do want to make it clear that, you know, we do have, as Jews, we have information about Hashem, and about his relationship with us, and about our souls, and about the purpose of our souls in this world, and about the importance of mitzvahs, and all this stuff, and where is it generally located? In Chassidus. So you do have to actually study Chassidus, but you know, once you've studied the Chassidus, and then you go take that stuff and think about it, like I said, I'm not even being hyperbolic when I say a five-minute walk once a week rewires your mind. And the emotional reaction, you don't have to even try to have one, the emotional reaction you will automatically have by thinking about, not just knowing, It's not just v'yadaita hayim, to know today, but v'sheveso levavecha, place it on your heart, that the 5 minutes a week of mentally processing, of willfully processing, running the software, and thinking about infinity, thinking about hashkacha pratis, thinking about the Jewish people's mission in the world, any of the topics that Chassidus teaches, and just running that for 5 minutes and thinking it in your own words, it's impossible that you will not create powerful emotional reactions and rewire the way that you experience life for the rest of the week until Monday night class again comes around. You're going to the Monday night class? Yeah? By the way, Rabbi Wolf did not tell me that I'm supposed to pump the Monday night class. But basically, here's the deal. I'm going to come in here, I'm going to talk, I'm going to leave, and I have no idea what's going to come of it. But if I know that there's a Monday night class or a Thursday night class, then I have a little bit of hope that there's some continuity to whatever we've done here. So.
Very, very, very important announcement. Please just pay attention for a second. Number one, cars that are parked back here, I didn't realize the shops do open up a little later, and they really need you to move your cars. Number two, whoever didn't register, please go up there, and if you can take care of that, that would be very, very, very good. Number three, if you can also, those of you that